Hello and welcome to another edition of Extraordinary, ordinary people with extraordinary outlooks on life, not to mention our cheeky little side offering of B-sides with my friend, the actor Ed Stoppard, where every so often I let Ed loose in the podcast driving seat. If you are new to the series, a very special hello. Where have you been? My name is Marcus Marku, and I try and get under the skin of living our best life. The subject is always, what is the best way to live? We're not here for very long. Let's nail this. I talk to people I know, people I've bumped into, and in this case, today, people I'm actually married to, my wife, Victoria Marku. In this episode, we talk about football, and specifically Aston Villa, and how supporting this team through thick and thin and through despair and misery till death do us part has brought my family closer together. Over to Victoria. Hello, Victoria.
Hello.
We're really here to talk about the way that football has played a part in our lives. It was a conversation that we were scratching the surface of a few days ago, if you remember.
Yeah, I do remember. And I remember thinking how much it had played a part throughout our whole relationship in different ways with different parts of your family and me, and then our family.
I mean, when I first met you, you weren't really into football, were you?
I was one of those people who got kind of caught up in things like the World Cup and sort of big important games, but I didn't ever follow a team or anything like that because it wasn't part of my upbringing. I grew up with a single parent, just me and my mum, no siblings. And football, you know, I grew up in the 80s really, and football was not something that nice middle class girls like me were into.
But you were hardly middle class and you grew up in Battersea. Well, in a one bed flat.
Yeah, my mum was a bit of a black sheep of the family. So my family's quite middle class, but my mum sort of married outside of that.
So when we first met, you were kind of doing eye rolls at the football thing.
I was doing eye rolls at the amount of time I thought the football thing would take up because it's massively time consuming being really, like, really into football. And I just thought, you know, we were like a young couple. We were, what, 23?
No, younger.
22? I mean, really young.
And the turning point was seeing Aston Villa win at Wembley, the 1994 victory against Man United on TV when I was there with some friends.
Yeah, that was a big thing. And I remember my mum was kind of very excited that I was in a kind of relationship and kind of really liked you, and she knew that you'd gone. And so she put it on the TV and she said, look, Marcus's game is on TV. And so when you've got an invested interest in either a team or somebody being there or something like that, that can sometimes be the hook that gets you.
And I remember the next day, everybody talking about that match because no one was really expecting Aston Villa to win. It was a really dominant Man United team. It had Kanchelskis and Cantona, Ince, Hughes. And I do remember we had the advantage of Schmeichel dropping out at the last minute, replaced by Les Sealy. And Big Ron went with kind of a different formation that he'd played that season, five across the middle, threw in Graham Fenton, we'd never even heard of. And it was a bit of a smash and grab by Villa because that was the season people were predicting Man United to do the treble. And Villa snuck in there very quickly. And it was the talk, really, wasn't it? The next day, because everyone I spoke to the next day who'd seen it on TV could not believe how well Villa had upended Man United's dominance.
Yeah, it was the classic kind of underdog, and I've always loved a bit of the underdog thing. And so, yeah, it was even easier to then get behind it because it wasn't just I was jumping on the bandwagon of like following United, or wasn't even Man City at the time, but you know, those kind of big clubs. It was Villa, who massive, massive club, but not that high profile in the way that, you know, United was at the time. Also, that's another thing, because I'm a big underdog person. So it was another hook to kind of get me into it.
But it was weird how you got into it, because it kind of happened at the same time as my family disintegrating. And you became one of the key drivers for all of us going to football matches in the 90s. Almost a conscious decision on your part, wasn't it, to embrace football as a way of bonding me with my dad and my brothers and me connecting back to Birmingham. Were you conscious of that? It felt like at times you were conscious of that being a thing.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day because it seems so weird now in the kind of age of technology that we're in. But at the time, this is like 25 plus years ago, we didn't have internet in the same way. We didn't have, you know, all the streaming of the games and all that sort of stuff. So it was really difficult to get to see games. And sometimes literally we would be, you know, it would be local radio. You couldn't even get it on mainstream radio. And so it was almost as if there needed to be a reason to connect with your family rather than just go up for the weekend to see your dad because just to see him. It was almost like, well, why don't we go for the football? And then, and sometimes we would drive up from London to Birmingham and listen to, you know, an away game on the local radio.
Extra AM and with Tom Ross.
We would do that and we would just, and then we'd sort of hang out at your dad's and just be around. And then it sort of progressed from there, really. So was it a conscious decision? Probably in a way, yes. It was like, well, we've got a reason to go, so why don't we go? And, you know, I wasn't getting my mini breaks in Paris, so I might as well go to Birmingham for the weekend. So it seemed like a little sort of mini holiday at the same time.
And my dad would surprise us sometimes, like that day when we had driven up from London just to listen to the local Extra AM broadcast of Coventry Villa.
Yeah.
And my dad surprised us saying, why don't we just go?
Yeah.
And we just rocked up to the ground, got tickets, 1995.
Yeah.
And Dwight York scored back then the fastest goal
in Premiership history.
At that point. It was like 2017. Savo was on fire that day and Villa were astounding. And to this day, that was one of my favourite matches because we had no expectation of going.
We didn't think we'd even get tickets, but
we just rocked up and we just got last minute tickets on the gate and we got in and we were like almost at ground level.
I'd never been to an away game before either at that stage. So that was really exciting. And I was shocked at the kind of rivalry as well, because it's not exactly a local derby like Villa Birmingham, but it's...
Well, it was then.
No, I was shocked at the vitriol and stuff of like grown men. It was really exciting. It was a spontaneous thing to do. You know, just like when we would go to games and we would be late and your dad would, you know, find back routes. And it was all quite exciting. Just that whole thing. And sometimes it would only be the three of us, be me, you and your dad.
It's true.
I could see that the relationship with your dad, without the football, there wasn't much kind of common ground there. And so with the football, at least we could talk about the game on the way there. We could then talk about the game on the way home and then, you know, watch Match of the Day and analyse it and talk about it again. So it gave that kind of common ground. And I have found that that has been invaluable. Now I have a teenage son. You know, I'd like to think I have a really close relationship with him, but that bond of football is immense with us. And we're never, ever stuck for something to say.
I come from a divorced family and the impact of separation is considerable. You do feel that the family does drift apart after a separation. And football was fundamental. I mean, I remember when Andrew and Dino would come to some of the games, and Andrew wasn't really a big fan at the time, but like you say, it became an excuse to do it something and get out as a family. And in a strange way, you'd be the only sort of female there.
I usually was. And you know, and it was so strange for me because, as I say, growing up in a single parent family with no siblings, just me and my mum and my grandmother spent a lot of time with us. And so suddenly I'm in this family where there are three sons and a dad, but no mum around. It was like an eye-opener for me about how that you could see the kind of breakdown, but yet if there was a common ground, if there was a thread that kind of pulled you all together, then that's what it was. And so we would go off to the game and this is what I always try to explain to people about football. It's not just the game itself, although it is that. It's a sense of community. It's the rituals that go with it. You know, that you buy your coffee from the same place and you buy your burgers from the same place and you walk the same, you know, park in the same place and walk the same route to the ground. And, you know, it's like a whole experience. It's not just about, you know, I have friends who go, oh, I like football. And it's like, it's not just about football. It's everything that goes with it.
And the people that we've sat with over the past 25 years.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been ingrained in our lives.
Yeah.
The people that you sit alongside.
I mean, sometimes I'd see those people, you know, every other week, you know, home games are every other week. And I would see those people more than I would see my friends. And yet I knew nothing about them. I knew nothing about them outside of football. I didn't, a couple of them we might chat. And, you know, I remember we sat next to a lovely guy who worked in the HP sauce factory. And he was lovely. And he'll stick with me forever.
He was brilliant.
He was so lovely. And so sometimes you get people like that.
And he used to think that my dad looked like Anthony Quinn.
Anthony Quinn, that's right.
He used to say, hey, does your dad do a bit of the old Zorba?
That's right. And he was just brilliant. And he had a really tough life. You don't know much about these people, but sometimes you get the odd person that you would. And I remember his wife had some kind of either dementia or Alzheimer's or something. And his son had really bad Parkinson's and had to have a brain operation, I remember. And he had a really tough life, but he was so positive. And every time I would go up the stairs, I'd see his smiling face and it would just be so lovely. John. Never even knew his surname.
John. If you'd have to countenance that with some of the miserable people we sat behind, like that guy with the pork pie hat for years.
Yeah, but they're funny. Those people are funny.
Who was so fundamentally miserable. When we sat down, he said, the first thing we did, this was years ago in the old Trinity Road stand, when we sat down to take our seats for the first time and we were so excited. We found there was a gap in the Trinity Road stand and my dad had managed to get us these tickets and we'd moved seats to a better position. And he announced that his closest friends of 20 years had lost their application for those seats. Oh, do you remember?
Right, that's right. And we'd got them.
And we were the most hated people.
I know. And he was like, but don't worry, I won't hold it against you, which meant he clearly did.
He held it against us for years. And for years. He was funny. Every time someone attacked the Villa goal, he would start off with a low murmur. I nicknamed him Dodgy because he'd go,
oh, yeah.
He'd just go, Dodgy, Dodgy, Dodgy. It just escalate in pitch.
And he would moan about, he'd yell at players as if they could hear him.
Yeah, well, the Hugo was a classic. He'd just go, watch him, you, from a corner, he'd go. Watch him, Hugo. Hugo, watch him, Hugo. And then he'd grab me and he'd say, I told Hugo, didn't I? I told him to watch him.
And there'd be a goal and he would blame Hugo every time. I said, didn't I? And he didn't listen. And
anyway, miserable. The classic story about him, Dodgy. You couldn't get a word out of him in the stand. And then I remember when they demolished the Trinity Road stand and they rebuilt it, years later, I bumped into him. Like in the foyer.
That's right.
And he was the friendliest person I've ever met.
Really positive.
How's it going? I think one of the funniest scenes ever was walking out of Villa Park and seeing that
guy.
Very large guy. Massive.
It was horrible. It was pouring with rain. It was grey. It was cold. It was windy. It had been a rubbish game.
Oh, it was awful. It was just classic Villa. And he said something. I remember him saying.
It was with his girlfriend.
That's the worst game I've ever seen, and that's saying something because I've seen some right shit here.
His girlfriend's probably behind me, just like, yeah.
That's classically sums up a lot of the endings of Villa matches in the past decade, hasn't it? Walking out in the rain,
terrible weather,
miserable, going, what are we doing?
I know. Why do we do this? But we know that we'll be back the following home game. And
when we got our kids into it, it was.
Yes, and it takes it to another
it
level.
It took it to another level, didn't it?
Well, I think also the thing about the football, like I was saying, it's to do with the rituals, it's to do with the whole process around it, is I was always somebody who was desperately searching for a sense of community. I'd had this really insular childhood with just, me, my mum, and my grandma a lot of the time. My mum was a practicing alcoholic, so we didn't have people at the house. We didn't have kind of family friends. So I grew up really, really in a really small environment. And I was always looking for a sense of community. You remember when I used to say, I want to go and live in a kibbutz, I wanted to live in a commune. And I think what football really gave me, strangely, was that sense of community, that sense of, we are all in this together. We all have a common interest. We're all completely different. I mean, the people that I would meet in football, I wouldn't come across in my normal life because I'm not, wasn't living in Birmingham.
Although can I just interject? You do have a very strong connection to Birmingham and Villa because
which I didn't know at the time.
For about 5 years of the last 25 years of going to Villa, we used to park in George Road and then would we then walk from George Road?
No, we would park with your dad in George Road and then we'd meet your brother who was coming from somewhere else and then we would drive in.
But we'd leave one of the cars in George Road. And your grandmother grew up in George Road.
Yeah.
And her brothers were all Villa fans.
Yeah, yeah, because my grandmother...
And we found the house.
Grew up there in, the 20s?
Yeah, because George Road is a stone's throw from Villa Park.
Yeah, and my mum used to spend summer holidays at in George Road, because it overlooked a park, and there was, she's telling me how she's going to feed the ducks in this park, and I didn't connect the two until we had been parking there for a while, and I suddenly realized. And then I went to visit the house, weirdly, with my mum many years later. But yeah, so there was always this kind of strong connection, maybe subconsciously.
Now we have children, and there was a period where, when Alexander was born, where actually going to Villa Park was the free bit, because we'd leave him and and Constantine when he was younger too with Jane, who was like my dad's housekeeper, and
she was your old nanny, and she was a
surrogate grandmother,
Alexander's
really.
Godmother,
and sadly a blues fan, yeah, and would create all sorts of mischief and hot debates. But we benefited from leaving the kids with her.
Yeah, well, especially when Alexander was born, because he was our first, and we didn't have family around us when we were living in London. We didn't have any family around us because my mum wasn't living in London when he was born. And so we were sort of quite isolated. You know, we were new parents. We were, like all new parents, massively overwhelmed, not really sure what we were doing, and with very little sleep and little time to ourselves. So it gave us and you know, Jane used to be a nanny, so she was perfect. I mean, she was so good with him. And so we would just be able to leave him with her. And just, I remember driving away and just feeling that sort of, you know, typical new mother's kind of guilt that I was leaving him, but also massive rush of like euphoria and freedom. It was the only time we had either to ourselves or kind of away from him.
Interestingly, we would, in the 90s, we took Jane's son Oliver to the Villa, and she's a massive blues fan, and we converted him to the Villa.
Yeah, we did the right thing there. But she, yeah, it was a kind of weird sort of cycle the way it worked, because at the time, it was before we had kids, but she was a single mom, Jane was. And so for her, not having her son for Saturday afternoon again was like her only respite.
So she was willing to give up the loyalty of Birmingham City for her respite. And I do remember in the 90s taking Oliver to the Wimbledon match with you. I don't think you were there. I can't remember.
Yes, I was there.
But why did I end up taking to? Oh, because he's a boy. So I remember. I mean, of the 7 goals that day, I missed 3. Because I was taking Oliver to the toilet.
Yeah, because he was a small boy.
And I remember one guy.
Bladder control.
One guy just in front of us going, "You missed another one."
Oliver still remembers that as well.
You're a woman that's grown up with very few men.
Very few men around. No men around. Really.
Okay. You suddenly joined this very male-heavy family.
Yeah.
And you've got into football.
Yep.
And now it's paying dividends for you in terms of your relationship with a teenage boy.
Yeah.
It's a difficult relationship, isn't it?
I think...
Between a mother and a teenage boy.
Yeah, because there needs to be some kind of common ground. Alexander and I have music, you know, we go to music gigs and stuff together as well, which is really lovely. But football has been the thing that has really bonded us. And it is genuine and authentic. It's not like I'm pretending to be into football so that I can talk to my son about FIFA or, you know, something. There's a genuine love there for my son, obviously, but also for football. And so there is always something for us to talk about. And it's funny because even when we've had arguments, you know, not related to football, and he's stomped off or whatever, or I've stomped off. And then when we sort of come back together, quite often the way in, he'll say, "Oh, have you heard the team news? Or have you heard the latest about Grealish or whatever?" And it's like a little, you know, in a road back into us getting along again. There's always football there, and the rituals of taking him to the games, it's just so lovely.
I mean, however bad family life can get sometimes, it can't be worse than Villa's plight at times.
No, absolutely.
What astounds me is the midweek games. You take Alexander, I take my hat off to you both, because it's like a 6-hour round trip.
It's a grueling round trip, it is.
And it's midweek, and he has to go straight after school.
Yeah.
And you have to go through the most rigorous routine. I mean, I don't go on these because it's just...
But it's grueling. I leave the house at 3. I pick him up at 3:30.
What time are you back at home?
The game is sort of either 7:45 or 8:00, and we get back at about midnight, 12:30. Sometimes a bit later, but the deal is if he does it, he's not allowed to miss school, obviously, the next day. So he has to, you know, be up to date on all his homework and stuff and go straight to bed when we get back.
I mean, the theme for this conversation is the importance of supporting Aston Villa in terms of it being like a glue to family life?
It's something that bonds us all together. We have a common interest, and also it extends. So, you know, for your dad, his grandson is massively into Villa, even to the extent that he's wanting to choose his university based on obviously the course, but knowing that he could, you know, if he went to Birmingham University, for example, he could still go to Villa. And it's so nice for your dad as well, because it's like his extended family are still going week after week. So he sees us every other week.
And now my brother Dino brings his kids.
Yeah. So Theo, who is what, 7, a massive Villa fan.
Massive.
And
met John McGinn during lockdown.
During lockdown for a socially distance picture. And it is really lovely, because we get to see him, we get to see Theo, so they, you know, there gets to be a bond with the cousins, even though there's, you know, for Alexander, who's what, 15 and Theo is 7, there's a massive age gap, but yet they've got a common interest. And quite often we'll drive in one car and Theo will tell us all his predictions and stuff, and we'll talk about
and the memories game. Memories you like put that in the bank are massive.
Yeah. And you cannot beat, and this is the thing, this is what drags me to the games midweek when it's freezing and the traffic's bad.
And we're playing terrible football.
I mean, terrible.
The last 10 years.
You cannot beat a live game. You just can't. You can, and even sometimes the games will be on the TV and we will still go. And this is the same when we go to music gigs, actually. You cannot beat the live experience. So I would always do the journey up there midweek rather than watch it on TV.
And probably the most special day, I said we wouldn't talk about it, was obviously the promotion.
Oh, Wembley. Top 5 days of my life. Yeah. Including the birth of 2 of my children, yeah, go in there big as well.
What's interesting is this must be a common theme in a lot of families.
Yeah, I think so. When you get generations supporting the same team, it must be difficult if it goes outside of that.
Well,
and someone,
I mean,
wants to support a different
he
team.
Wanted, I mean, the truth is, the kids didn't want to support Villa early on because they were surrounded by Chelsea fans, remember?
Well, also, they were both born just down the road from where.
Yeah, but more importantly, all their friends were Chelsea. And
yeah,
I remember.
And they grew up in London.
And the first few years of them being Villa fans was hard, but now they're reaping the benefits because they're different.
They're
the, like, Villa fans in a school full of Chelsea and Arsenal.
Yeah.
And Man City.
Particularly Alexander. Yeah, particularly Alexander now, because their school's in Surrey and, you know, everybody is a Chelsea fan. Loads of them live near the Chelsea training ground. And so, yeah, to be Villa, I mean, he's the only Villa fan in his whole year.
The only Villa fan in the village.
In the village. Probably in the whole school.
Anyway.
And the whole town.
Up the Villa.
Up the Villa. Always up the Villa.
Before we obviously have to have a prediction before we log off. Will Aston Villa survive?
I'm saying yeah. I'm saying we're going to scrape by. We're going to just avoid relegation. Because it's like a new season starting.
I believe in Aston Villa's resilience. And I think genuinely, post-COVID, and I touched on this in the last podcast with Greg, the difference in sportsmen's ability to do well in this post-COVID environment will be down to mental resilience.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think if you look at our players, Mings, McGinn, Grealish, they've had to come up quite a difficult way, promotion from the Championship. Mm. I think we might just have the edge in terms of mental resilience. I really do. I predict some of the bigger teams will fall apart. Thank you, Victoria. That was a very good chat.
It's a pleasure. My favourite topic, my kids and football.
Bye.
Bye.
And that was Victoria Marku, my wife and the mother of my children. Next week, I will be talking to a young entrepreneur called Will Wood, who has built an exciting PR business in TV and film. But there's something different about him. He's entirely refreshing and nothing like you would imagine in TV and film PR. His clients is a who's who list. His feet are firmly on the ground, and he's still only in his 30s, early 30s. Tune in. You can get the very latest podcast on Spotify, and then a week later, they all go up on YouTube. You can follow me on Twitter. Until then, thank you and goodbye.